for coming, and thank you, Kendrick, for inviting me. So this is my first recorded seminar, so everything that I can say will be used in court against me, I guess. So I'm a PhD student in CISSA, about to finish, and I'm working under the supervision of Carlo Baccigalupi. I'm part of the Euclid collaboration, and so today I will speak about work which hopefully is very upcoming on the archive. We're quite close to submission, about n-body lens, the CMB maps, and lensing extraction algorithm and characterization of the extracted signal. So, brief outline. I will tell something about the first detections and measurements of the CMB lensing spectrum. Then I will talk about the all sky and flat sky lensing extraction algorithms that we are using. Then I will briefly sketch the characteristics of the CMB maps that we are using to that are lensed by the n-body boxes, and tell you about the results of our work. And then we'll give you some hints of my future work in this topic. So, sorry. So, ah, come on. Okay.
My fault.
Sorry. So, gravitational lensing on cosmic microwave background is, you wouldn't say, ordinary gravitational lensing, just that is enacted on the background of the microwave emission coming from the last scattering surface. So, of course, it is gravitational lensing happens when the path of a light ray crosses a massive body, massive structure. So the CMB is emitted at the Z1100. And then while the photons are traveling from the LSS to us, they meet structures that are arising in the universe because of the gravitational collapse. And so we, in the end, we receive the CMB with a small deflection angle with respect to what it would have been unperturbed. And so this makes gravitational lensing a secondary anisotropy, since it is not happening at the time of recombination. It has nothing to do strictly with the physics happening at recombination, but it's rather a modification that the photons get on the path coming from the emission to us. So, some formulas, so you can ask me more about it later, or also not, I'm happy anyway. Here I'm writing just something for the temperature field, but the stuff doesn't change for polarization spectra. So basically what we observe from a certain direction n, is the emission we will get from that direction plus a certain deflection angle alpha. For the gravitational lensing in GR, this is the expression that we obtain for the deflection angle, where the gradient of psi is the gradient of the three-dimensional gravitational potential. So we can infer a formula for the projected gravitational potential. And so what we get is that basically alpha, the deflection field, is related with the gravitational field that is between the source and us.
Okay, can I just ask a quick question? That factor of two, so usually just for a general theory of gravity, it's phi plus psi. Is that factor of two there? Because
this is because of GR.
Yeah.
Oh, of course, if you want to modify the stuff that's happening, this will change. But for our treatment, we stick to GR. what we are aiming to see basically is this kind of term, a first order term with respect to the ordinary emission regarding the temperature field. And this kind, this term, this deflection term, will be at quite small scales, with the root mean square of deflection being more or less 2 arc minutes. And so the lensing, which is generated by structures at very, very large scales, it is then enacting a distortion mainly on smaller scales of the CMB, so at very small angles. So first measurements for this phenomenon came from the ACT and SPT collaboration, and also ACT produced an interesting measurement of the detection of a non-zero value of omega lambda from CMB data alone using gravitational lensing, so of the CMB. So this is showing us that CMB lensing is an independent tool for cosmology and can help to break some degeneracies that are now still present in our data. Four sigmas from ACT and six more or less from SPT. Then, sorry?
The left figure, this shows the lensing
effect? Yes, this is the convergence field that was computed from the temperature spectra. This is 100,
yeah, yeah.
Yes.
And so. Then, so where does this lensing come from?
No, okay, this is the deflection spectra. Basically, what is happening is that the structure are at very large angles, but the biggest modification of the spectra is happening at higher else in the temperature spectrum. But this doesn't mean that you don't have the... a contribution also for for the degree scale, for example. And also this L that we show here is not the same L of temperature, because since CMB lensing is not a Gaussian process with respect to the ordinary fluctuation of the CMB, the L that we have here is the result of a coupling between different scales. So this L is not actually corresponding to an angular separation in the sky. This is not a two-point, the ordinary two-point correlation that we see is resulting from the coupling of different modes in the sky. So it's hard to say that this is coming from 1 degree in the sky. Yes, I mean L is a, is it, it it of course it is an angular separation, but it's not the angle subtended on the sky.
I think it may help to make the
comment. Oh, sorry.
That, these two parts use different analysis methods. The right part is just the direct measurement of the power spectrum of the CMB.
Yes.
Lensing shows up at high L. The plot on the left is made using a bunch of intermediate steps where you infer the existence of a degree scale lens by what it does statistically to the hot and cold spots on smaller scales. There's a Claudia's going to talk about all the intermediate steps, I guess, the quadratic estimator and so on. But this thing on the left is actually like a 4-point function of the CMB.
This is not the normal way that we used to think about in the CMB, because of course in a perfect Gaussian world, we wouldn't have gravitational lensing, because we wouldn't have anything that perturbs the spectrum of the CMB. So this is something, I mean, lensing is both coupling modes from different angular scales and also transferring power from the temperature spectra to the polarization spectra. So it is not only a non-linear process, but also quite non-trivial in the description of the mathematics underlying. But if you want to see more, I have some formulas in my backup slides, so I can show it later.
So is the fundamental quantity something, say, like C tilde L L prime, which tells you how powers transfer from one scale to another, and then you've done some sort of integral over this, or some sort of averaging procedure?
No, there is, I mean, I, to my knowledge, there is not an explicit operator that is telling you how much power you're transferring to one scale to another. Okay, let me skip immediately. This is what's happening, okay? So, yeah, it's quite complicated. Basically, what you have here is this L minus L1. The L is the like ordinary L that you observe as an angular separation. L1 is another L that corresponds to an actual angular separation in the sky. But then the lensing is coupling these two modes and transferring them to the first L. So it's not obvious. Basically, you have a big L here, which is L minus L1. And what you plot eventually will be the C of big L. So of course, we like to have our lives very complicated, and we call it the same with the same symbol. But it is not ultimately maybe a good choice. But yeah, it's not trivial thinking that it's not the same thing that you usually think about when you look at CMB stuff. So. Yes, exactly. This is exactly telling you this, that the highest coherence that you have for the underlying spectrum of the gravitational lenses is mostly coming from 1 degree scale potential. But this is ultimately telling you that you have the most of the structures that are lensing your signal is related to that scale. So yeah, this is exactly gets the point. So Planck measurements. So Planck measured in a very good way this signal, and produced shear maps, null tests that are excellent. So everyone loves Planck. So from now on, now that we have good quality measurements also of the lensing spectrum, to give you an idea, this precision is more or less the same full width of maximum that was given by Kobe for the CMB some like 20 years ago. So for lensing, we are now as precise as Kobe used to be. So we can start to gather ideas to how to use this kind of signal to do cosmology. So okay, this is older because we are not now only finishing the testing phase, but we are close to published results for an algorithm of lensing extraction, which is based on the Okamoto quadratic estimator, both for flat sky and full sky. We are applying it for the flat sky case because our scope in this work is to obtain the convergence spectrum. So this is still the differential L from CMB maps that are not lensed in the usual way, so with the semi-analytic calculation, for example, made by the LensPeak software, but to lens the unperturbed CMB maps using a stacking of n-body boxes, and in this way to get some non-linearities actually acting on the background emission. So in this way, we can target quite well the small scales of the CMB, and in some way also the small scales of the multiples of the deflection field. And so this is why we are we are justified to use a flat sky approach, because of course if we want to look at this part of the spectrum, the flat sky approximation is completely failing. This is a preliminary step to study the CMB and galaxy cross-correlation spectra, because of course we expect that the that this kind of signal that is coming from the interaction of photons with the underlying matter distribution will be will be related and will give a positive correlation or negative correlation with the signal coming from the galaxy themselves. So the quadratic estimator is built with the use of these two maps that are called gradient map and filtered map, okay, that you build with an estimation of the delensed spectra and with the actual CLs that you delensed CLs that you measure. So for the flat sky approach, these expressions are quite simple because you just switch to the harmonic space without having a lot of Fourier transforms to make. So you do the filter gradient map and high pass filter map. You switch to real space and combine them with a multiplication. You take the divergence, then you renormalize and it works like a charm. In the end, you get this very nice expression, very simple and straightforward expressions that you build up in your code, provided that you have a Gaussian distribution of CMB anisotropies in the sky, that you are in the small deflection angle regime. So of course this only works for weak lensing, but this is the case for CMB. That your noise is uncorrelated, that your convergence field is Gaussian, and you don't have any anisotropy foreground. And unfortunately, this is not exactly the case because, as we know, CMB has something in front that disturbs our observation. So this algorithm can only be applied to clean CMB maps.
The high pass filter?
No, okay. The name is high pass and gradient just because they mimic the effect of a high pass band and of the gradient on, for example, electronic signals. But there is no real physical reasons. This is a mathematical procedure that you say, okay, I want an estimate, I want a statistical unbiased estimator for this kind of observable. So it's something that comes out from the math, but you could have called them tomato and carrot, and the structure is not changing.
Yes.
No, it's not coming. I don't think that it's coming from that. If we want to look at it like this, we can say that in the high part of the L spectrum, of the original L spectrum, lies the most of information coming from lensing. But I never given really a thought of giving these two maps a physical interpretation, because it is a way with which you build an estimator, but this is not the only estimator that you can build.
So can you convert these into like a convergence map or something, an actual map, or is this just design?
Yes, then eventually I will show you the convergence map. Okay. So, in order to extract the information from the map, you cannot see clearly the green line, okay. you have to choose which experimental characteristics you will have for your experiment. So in this plot, I would like you to see also the green line here. That would be the Planck noise for the minimum variance estimator, and maybe you can see more clearly the blue line, which is the minimum variance noise for the estimator for a prism-like experiment, which is significantly better than Planck, both for the resolution and both for the sensitivity. It is crucial, anyway, not only to have a very good sensitivity here, but also to concentrate on the right combination of estimators, because you can the procedure that was that I showed before can be built with a number of combinations of maps. That's why it's not strictly speaking of the temperature, because you can also combine E and B or T and D. So it's not strictly the gradient of the temperature or the gradient of something, because you can build the gradient of E and combine it with the high pass of B, for example. So in that case, it's quite hard to give a straightforward physical interpretation of the two maps that you're combining. So for our case of the large L part of the spectrum, we see that the most significant spectra to look at are the EB1, that is quite low in the beginning, and the beam doesn't start to kick in too early, and the TT1, because the noise level is raising, of course, when L is becoming higher, but is not raising dramatically as, for example, the EE1, which starts with a lower noise level. So these are the two combinations that we will take into account in the ladder. So we used, as I was saying before, a flat sky approach. So we are building these two maps in the harmonic space, and our tiling is following the paper by Blazinski, Perotto, and others. You're using a gnomonic projection with a tiling that has an overlap factor almost 1/2. So we did some testing on LensPix realization of Lens CMB maps in order to check if our pipeline was able to recover a known cosmological signal. And we are still undergoing the phase of error characterization with the usual Monte Carlo method. So we are realizing a number of maps and projecting those, and then understanding the error with the understanding the error with the sigma of the displacement of the measurements on LensPix maps. So, but which maps are we using for the actual scientific aim of the paper? We want to have a map that is bringing in the effect of the N-body realization. So here, it's not very clear. Maybe I can do a sketch on the blackboard. So what's happening? You start in the center with your observer. You divide the volume of the universe in a shell, and you fill those shells with your N-body box. The thickness of the shell is always lower than the amplitude of the N-body box. When you shift from one shell to another, there is a randomization and a coherent rotation of the boxes in such a way to avoid the repetition of, okay, besides the fact that I obviously cannot draw, you in this way it is ensured that you are not meeting the that your photon is not meeting the same structure more than once. So of course, this would introduce a bias in your lensing reconstruction. Since with this approach you cannot obviously recover scales which are bigger than the typical size of the simulation box, the higher scales are artificially put in using the CAMB software. So you compute with the semi-analytical method the scales up to L400, and regarding the lower scales, we use the Born approximation in this case to compute the deflection field of the underlying structures. So, of course, the Born approximation is not taking into account the single scatters that happen in the during the travel of the photon to us, but is rather doing an integral on all the line of sight. So it is just computing a single deflection angle. To go beyond this approximation, one would need to do the ray tracing procedure by following the photon path and computing the deflect. Okay, I cannot draw, so excuse me. here you have the CMB. Here you have your beautiful large scale structures. Basically, the Born approximation is just computing the integral from here to here and giving as a result a single deflection angle. On the other hand, what you would like to do is you have some field here, some field here, etc. So you have your unperturbed photon here that gets deflected some in this way. So you have a first angle alpha here, then it travels in this way, and it gets deflected in this way. So you have another result, a different resulting angle, and so on and so forth. So this kind of approach is more refined than the Born approximation, because you are subdividing your volume of integration in subsequent shells, and this is called the multiple lens plane approximation. And so using this kind of approach, as I will show you now, okay, is giving you a better reconstruction of the deflection field at L's larger than 3000, which were not the subject in this work, but will be investigated in a future paper.
So this is still like Born approximation, but over little slices.
Yeah.
Right?
Like since you have a discrete simulation, anyway, you cannot have the continuous thing. But when you go like this is without, this is the red is with the Born approximation, and the blue is with the multiple lens. So this kind of this difference is around 10% here.
More finely to see, you know, how it converges or something.
So this is not the part of the project I'm following. This is being done by another part of the group in CISA, so I wouldn't be able to give you the exact answer to this. But I think that a number of trials have been done for the distance of these multiple lens planes. I think that ultimately, given the size of the simulation box and the number of computational parameters, you can understand which is the optimal separation between these subsequent planes. Because if you already know that your potential is going to be shaped somehow, and you cannot look at more refined structures than that because you have a discrete simulation box, you know that you won't be gaining a lot by having more and more and more planes than that. Sorry. Okay. The red is with the Born approximation, and the blue is with the multiple lens approximation, and the relative difference is shown here.
What is one?
One is the CAMB prediction. Okay. In here, there is a discrepancy, quite obvious discrepancy, that is given by the failure of the remapping algorithm. So this is something that is still undergoing some huge modifications, because now another algorithm for the remapping is being implemented by Fabian and Stomper, following the algorithm proposed by Fabian and Stomper in 2013. So this happens when you switch from the lens peaks map to the from the deflection map of the potential going to the lens peaks coordinates. So you have to reform all the CMB maps or CMB map all over again in order to follow the angle. And then you have to remap it back. So when you do this, you have a lot of numerical error. But this is now taken into account using a different algorithm. Anyway, the difference that is shown here is only depending from the fact that you are abandoning the Born approximation. So this is not a numerical. I mean, this difference is not a numerical feature of the remapping, but it is something that is actually happening in the that you gain when you have this more refined approach. Sorry. No, this is the lens CL. This is not lensing. No. This is not something that is happening only due to nonlinearities. This is a known effect. This is a numerical effect that is coming from the remapping issues, like this factor of 3 or 4. Is not something that the nonlinearities are adding to CAMB. Not all of these, at least. Okay.
Okay. So you think this? We just.
No, this thing is an issue now. I'm showing this plot just to say, okay, there is a difference here that translates into a relative difference of 10%. This thing is now being taken care of by the implementation of a new algorithm for remapping.
So we should.
Exactly. Exactly. Basically, this was maybe saying more, but this one had colors, so it was showing the difference more clearly.
Is linear perturbation theory still valid on those multiple scales?
This is a good question. This is why we are exactly why we are trying to do this kind of study, because we want to see. I mean, when you track down all the effects here, and you are able to cross out the remapping issues that were studied before with just linear theories maps, and then you went down to see if what you recover is the same thing you plugged in. If we see a difference after erasing the remapping issues, we are quite confident that energy saving. That's what we are going to see will be some difference that is given by the n-body power and so on, the actual kicking in of the nonlinearities at very large scales, very large angular scales, small scale.
One little comment is that CAMB includes nonlinear fractions for the deflection power spectrum, but they're based on fitting functions too.
What's the status of, there have been a couple of papers you've written second order bolts on the coast to calculate things like the CMB and things like that. What's, have they got any estimates of the scale at which needs to become important?
Oh, I think you're talking about nonlinear corrections to the deflection power spectrum, which are kind of important. Like on these scales, they're like 20%. Nonlinear corrections to the Boltzmann equations before recombination are much smaller.
Anyway, these results are in an upcoming paper from my colleague that will explain and tell you all you want to know about going beyond the Born approximation with these kind of maps. So what we now applied our pipeline to the Millennium Run N-body simulation box. We already have available another set of maps coming from coupled dark energy cosmologies on a lambda CDM background. So these codex maps are done by letting the n-body box evolve following different cosmological histories. We have an exponential field coupled to dark energy. Then this is the ordinary lambda CDM case, and also a supergravity model. So besides the theoretical differences of these underlying models, what is interesting for us is that these three models are producing a different clustering. I hope that you can see it quite clearly from the pictures. For example, in the exponential mode model, you can see that there is more intensity at the small scales, but you are losing some clustering on the large scales with respect to lambda CDM and to the supergravity model. And so this will give a modification in the signal of the CMB lensing. And so we would like to see in the future whether you are able to distinguish between those models using the pipeline that we are finishing to prepare now. So basically, you have these three maps. You place your data points for all the different maps, and you see, okay, so how good can I be with the different experimental specifications to distinguish between those cosmologies? And these boxes are more refined with respect to the Millennium Run because they have the double of side, and they have a lot of particles. Also, they have baryon in those, while the Millennium Run had only dark matter. So there is also some physics that is coming in.
Okay, so I thought that by dark energy, by interacting dark energy cosmologies, you just meant quintessence models.
No, it's coupled. Energy. Coupled is not.
Is beta zero, beta one?
Okay, I would have to look at the equations, but beta is the I think it's these are the coupling constants. Okay, the beta one you can also not considering it because it's in a model that is not generating these maps, so you can forget beta one because it's zero in all the relevant cases. So alpha is the exponent in front of the field, and I think that beta zero is the coupling constant that you have with the dark matter.
You'll have a conservation equation which is not rho dot plus 3h rho equals zero because you've got coupling between the matter and the scalar field. So you'll have some term on each side, and that'll be proportional to beta zero.
Okay. Do you need this coupling?
For intrinsic dark energy.
Well, it's not that you need it. It's something that people are thinking about, say, okay, we have a dark sector of the universe. So since we already don't know anything about either dark energy and dark matter. Why shouldn't them be coupled together in some way that we cannot measure it? So, yes, of course, it's constrained. That's why you have these values for beta. But yeah, I mean, it's an interesting thing that you can consider.
How highly constrained is it? Because this is the thing when you have these interacting models. If you just consider one model of interacting dark energy, then you will get very, very tight constraints. If you just let your model vary yeah. completely and just look at the console plots, it's completely unconstrained. I thought this was the whole point of Euclid.
Yes, this would be the whole point of Euclid, but I wouldn't be able to tell you how tightly these parameters are constrained, even because when you want to constrain this kind of theoretical predictions, you enter the domain of model dependency. So it is very hard. I mean, now also the constraints on the usual parameter set that we see every day are being reconsidered, like saying, okay, but this is not a completely model independent approach. So I think that a lot of awareness is being now raised in the community about this issue of the fact of that we are not able really to say also for Planck all the problem of the inconsistency between Planck and HST and the neutrinos and a lot of stuff. I mean, we are having a lot of problems with the tensions between different data sets because what we want to get out just, you know, numbers and error bars. But ultimately, the process, the way that we treat data is hiding a lot of hypotheses that we are putting in that are not actually in the data. And so if we oversimplify, in the end, we will have beautiful answers that won't agree with each other or that are hiding our knowledge.
On that point as well. Yeah. So currently, different n-body simulations of the same cosmological scenarios will disagree by 10% just because you're running them on different codes with different procedures. Which one do you believe and how sensitive are your to the changing input? Because I know the Euclid science goal is 1% agreement over all simulations, but currently 10%.
Okay, I'm not in the simulation part, so I don't know. My best answer is I'm a theoretician, so I really don't know. I can ask to the people I know in the simulation groups, but there's a lot of stuff going on because now people say we should put hydrodynamics in. Others say, no, we don't care. Others say, but your dimension is weird. What? No, like the dimension of the box is not matching with some other parameter. So the simulation territory is really like a pool filled with sharks. So it's very hard to have the ultimate answer to what is the best simulation. You can only say, okay, we have a disagreement of, I don't know, 10%, 5%, so our confidence is 5%. Okay, so the validation, for the validation, as I was anticipating before, we used LensPix generated maps. So the lensing here is computed with semi-analytical models. And so we said, okay, we have a confidence cosmology, so we must exactly recover the same thing because arbitrarily nothing weird is happening. A lot of weird stuff has been happening since I've been testing this algorithm, but apparently now we are fine. Here I'm showing the TT and EB estimators for prism specifications. So there is nothing to say about the agreement because it is perfect as it should be. And so we can now apply it on maybe more interesting maps and see what we find. So we find a very good agreement also for the n-body simulations, which is telling us two things. The first thing is that our algorithm is working well also on n-body, also when the n-body features are added, and also that on the scales, the semi-analytic computations that we have from CAMB are well compatible with the results that we get from the n-body computation. So to see interesting differences, with respect to the ordinary semi-analytic behavior, we will need to go further down in the angular scales. And so this means that the fact of being able to track the photons going beyond the Born approximation will be more and more important. Also, we reconstructed the shear map that someone was asking about before. So, the scale is almost invisible. The red is the units are. I think arbitrary normalized units because the potential is dimensionless. So I have to check which are the units with which this plot is produced. Anyway,
the reason I ask is because I'm in the CFHT lens collaboration, right? And we have maps of the convergence from galaxies. So it would be kind of cool to compare them with maps from the CMB, but I don't know if the noise and the scale structures line up.
Yeah, this makes me terrified to answer. So I can the angular scale this should be a 15 degree patch.
We have four patches which are like
150 square degrees in total. So they're like six on average they're like 6x6 or something. Four patches of roughly 30 to 40 square degrees.
I would imagine the cross correlation with quantum protein is detectable.
Sorry?
I would imagine the cross correlation with quantum protein is detectable.
Planck did some cross correlation. Planck did some cross correlation of Lansing with other observables already.
Yeah, with other large scale structure probes, but not. I don't think anyone has cross correlated CMB Lansing and galaxy.
Yes. Yeah, it should be heavy.
And since our resources are at redshift of like 1, that's getting a lot of the structure already, right? I don't know how much more comes from beyond 1.
CMB peaks at a redshift of around 2, so
does it?
Actually significantly.
Okay.
It's
interesting.
The
so it's
kernel,
our tomography, right?
The kernel for the Lansing is around, Z between 1 and 2, so. Anyway.
The universe is pretty smooth up there.
the lens of kernels now. What was it used?
Yeah, so is that the lensing kernel, or is it the where the signal is coming from? You know what I mean?
Sorry, I should let
because the structure is growing as a function of time, right?
Yeah.
And so even though you have structures at redshifts, high redshifts, there is no structure at those high redshifts. It's still very low amplitude.
Well, I mean, the kernel is peaking at z. I don't know the exact value, but I think it's from 1 and 2 or something. So.
But is that just it's sensitivity, and then you want to multiply that by delta of z? Right, or you know, so you want to weight that by how the structure grows as a function of cosmic time, and that
yes.
is peaking at very low redshifts, right? So it's very small at high redshifts. So what is where is the mean if you multiply those two things together? That's what I'm curious about. You see what I mean?
Well, yes, I see what you mean, but then it's also what I like about dancing is that there is this wonderful. Coincidence that the peak of the kernel is exactly coincidence with the start of action of the dark energy. So the most interesting thing is or at least the most interesting thing that I see, is the fact that you can you have a nice kernel peaked at a cosmic moment where you have a new species that is starting to dominate, and so the dark energy. I mean, as it was, as you could see here. This is a result at the redshift equals zero. So basically from Z4 or 6 on, the difference of the evolving histories here is creating a lot of different kind of clustering and of structures. So the interesting thing
right,
is...
Right, but it probably looked very similar at redshift
mm-hmm.
2. And then
yes.
You're really seeing the difference at low redshift. So... you're measuring the convergence map, which is, you know, it's some
mm-hmm.
kind of like kernel times sigma 8 of Z or something
mm-hmm.
like that. So, you know, where does that thing peak, right? That's too much
lower. That is the thing that peaks at 2.
Oh, that
peaks,
is
the peak
is
at
2
in the growth function.
It's not the sensitivity, it's the actual...
that's right. The factor of the growth function, of course, pushes it to lower redshift. But even the fact that the peak is at around 2.
You have to see the plots to fully understand.
Yeah, but then I mean, eventually, what is happening is that you're not only using CMB lensing alone. You want to use CMB lensing and correlate it with very nice, accurate galaxy surveys, like for
right.
example Euclid, which is a part of work that I will talk about
well,
in a few minutes.
Galaxy surveys are galaxy surveys, right? You
yes.
cross-correlate with lensing maps derived
yes.
from shapes of galaxies, but still measuring the dark matter. Now you have dark matter,
mm-hmm.
dark matter, right? And you can compare those two. They have different redshift sensitivities. And presumably
mm-hmm.
there's something to be learned by doing that.
Yeah, right.
How much does that statement change if you're only looking at very small scales?
That's true. The peak redshift is sort of open.
Because mm-hmm. if you're really looking at like a few thousand, then potentially skew things to like times or something.
Oh, that's absolutely.
I'm sorry, the other thing about the plots that you were just showing, the dashed lines are the noise, is that right?
Yes. The red dashed line is the noise and the...
How do you do so well?
What?
How do you do so well at high L? That's what the noise is like.
Okay, the error bars are built... with the okay, these error bars are not the actual Monte Carlo error bars, but I mean, if you want even a more striking answer to this, I can go back here. The noise level for Planck is like here, so you could say, how did they measure it? This they measured this because they built like 1,000 or 2,000 of simulated maps. They extracted the signal from those maps, and the error bars that you see here are the standard deviation of the displacement of the error bars.
So this is so the noise that you were plotting later is the is like the zeroth order to the one that you get from the fact that your
no.
estimate.
Okay, this noise is the theoretical noise of the estimator. The error bars that I'm showing here are the standard deviation of the displacement, but over the patches in my map. So these error bars are hiding some internal correlation because they, of course, the patches, since they are coming from the same statistical realization, are not independent one from the other. So this is what is happening. The way that this should be done and that we are currently doing is by getting a lot of maps, different maps, extract, apply all the pipeline, extract these signals, and then what you are eventually going to get is, I don't know, 1,000 of the spectra. Then you compute for each L-bin the standard deviation of the displacement of the data points, and that is ultimately your error, computed with a Monte Carlo approach. So this is the correct explanation of the error bars. Okay, So we are doing this because, as you can see quite nicely from this plot, that is referring to the codex maps that I was showing before. When you plot the ratio, for example, of the different three evolving dark energy histories with respect to the CAMB coefficients of lambda CDM, you see that you have quite a difference in the contributions between the three, for example, the three models that I was showing before. So, for example, the blue is the exponential is the exponential model of coupled dark energy. So you have a signal which is significantly higher, that is the one above here, with respect to the one of lambda CDM and with respect to the one of supergravity. And also here it is shown the difference that you have when you consider the n-body simulations with respect to CAMB. This represents the same effect that I was saying before, mostly, but when you I cannot spot the correct line, so it's quite hard. But basically, this is the issue of the remapping here kicking in, and you also, if you have very good eyesight, you can spot here some difference which is being given by the effect of nonlinearities. So the hidden things that we are trying to look at now is getting different CMB lens maps and trying to place constraint to the different evolving histories of different expansion histories, and also to try to track down the contribution of long linearities at very high L in order to say, okay, so if we want to have a linear or semi-analytical treatment, we can do well until here. From there on, if you use n-body, you see a difference. Now, final part.
We should try to wrap up the
news. Yes, it's the two last slides. I will tell you what I have been doing this summer, besides all the rest. I've been visiting the ICG in Portsmouth, and I worked under the supervision of Will Percival to build forecasts for the standard six cosmological parameters and the bias function of Z. And dark energy history and the FNL parameter for non-Gaussianities, considering the specifications of Planck and Euclid. So I have built a Fisher matrix code that takes into account TE and Psi angular spectra from Planck and the angular spectra of galaxies coming from Euclid. So basically the Fisher matrix is giving an optimal prediction that is neglecting a lot of other stuff. But on the other hand, it's neglecting unknown degeneracies or systematics of the instruments foreground. So of course it's not ultimately how the real precision of the how the instrument is going to be good when it measures when it delivers the data, but on the other hand it's interesting to check what comes out from this kind of analysis, because you can start to think, okay, so it's giving you a hint on where you can be, when you can have a very good performance, and on the other hand where you expect to be having some issues. So these are all the combinations of the angular spectra that I am now considering. And also I am using an approach of dividing my galaxy survey into redshift shells in order to exploit the differential information that comes in from the fact that I have an evolution in time. So the parameters on which I am computing the constraints are the standard six cosmological parameter data set. Then I have a bias evolving as a function of Z. I have parameterized the dark energy following the Chevalier-Polanski-Linder parametrization W0 and WA. And I have the local non-Gaussianities FNL, but using FNL as an evolving, a contribution to an evolving bias. So the constraint on FNL in this regard is complementary to the one that has already been given by Planck, because Planck has published a constraint on FNL that was computed by considering the tri-spectrum of the CMB, so higher order spectra of the CMB, while in this framework, the constraints from FNL are coming from the fact that primordial non-Gaussianities should influence the way that the bias evolves also in the recent universe. Pardon? Yes, yes.
Are you allowing FNL to be scale dependent?
No, FNL is not scale dependent, but the bias will be scale dependent. At least in my in the way that I'm using it, the FNL is not going to be scale dependent.
I forget who I was talking to about this, but apparently you can allow for some sort of modulation of FNL and still have large effects on galaxy clustering scales while still having, while still satisfying the Planck bound. I can't quite remember the full details now.
I don't know about this. I mean, for FNL, I'm using the standard parameterization, it has constant. So.
I think you did something pretty steep, that the large structure effect comes from squeeze triangles where the, large K Lagrangians are the Lagrangian scale of halos, which is say 5 millimeters. So that corresponds to an L of around 3,000 in CMB. Planck goes almost that far. After to hide it in CMB and then have kick it, you did something nice.
So what's G?
What
for correlation?
Galaxies.
Sorry.
G is galaxy, yeah, okay. T and psi are obvious, and G is the galaxy angular power spectrum.
How general is the parameterization W0 and WA?
Pardon?
So can you capture a lot of dark energy models using just W0 and WA?
Well, basically, when you use W0 and WA, you are measuring the departure from a constant dark energy equation of state. So you're looking at the zero order and the first order. Yeah, so, I mean, if you are in a very unlucky case where you have W0 equal to minus one and WA equal to zero, but you have some departure in the second order derivative, you cannot see with this parameterization, of course. But since we are completely model dependent when you are looking at dark energy, this is of course a phenomenological parameterization.
I'm asking because there's been a big push in the community to do dark energy in a model independent way, and they've got all these parameterizations where essentially they lump all their extra degrees of freedom into an effective equation of states, and by constraining the equation of state like that, you can pull out things about things like dark energy, coupled dark energy, modified gravity, things like that. I'm just wondering how this maps onto some of these parameterizations.
An approach that is now being followed in this framework is the principal component analysis. So instead of looking at like W0 and WA, they are reanalyzing, for example, CMB data and also survey data how can I explain it in a short way? Basically, they recompute the basis of the operator. They reproject on the different eigenvectors So instead of having, for example, the usual degeneracy plots.
You're talking about the principal components done by Levon and Simon Silvestri and people like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So but they find five free functions and you've only got two there.
No, okay, of course, but in this case, I'm looking at the Fisher matrix analysis. So having a lot of parameters here wouldn't even help me a lot because I'm already neglecting so many other things. So, I mean, yeah, I could have an infinite number of parameters, but besides the fact that I should open CAMB and force inside a lot of other parameters, maybe it's not the correct, the Fisher matrix is not the correct approach to take into account all those other things. Because, I mean, the principal component analysis is now being used with Markov chains. So with like methods that enable you to account for the full likelihood of the data. In this case, you're considering that everything is perfect and Gaussian. So neglecting the fact that you have the unknown degeneracies here, or that you might have systematic effects that actually shift the position of the center of your parameters. You're going more refined in a direction, but you already know that you won't be able to trust having this more and more parameters. I mean, at least this is my personal feeling about this. Of course, W0 and WA is not a satisfying parametrization, but on the other hand, data available now are still not constraining them, saying, okay, for sure W0 is minus one and for sure WA is zero. So it's still worth looking at those. Of course, when we will have Euclid data, it will be time to go beyond and try to be even more model independent. Okay, so highlights and future work in 3 seconds. So high resolution CMB experiments are now giving us a new challenge of interpreting our data also, let's say, in a creative way. Like we have to look for second order effects with which to refine our measurements of cosmological parameters. The combination of different probes is now allowing for breaking some degeneracies that we already know about in data. What's possibly also to consider is having a realistic simulation of the Lensing distortion field on CMB emission, considering also different Dragonelli histories in order to pose constraints on the possible different evolution, as a both as a standing alone project and both as a preparation for the cross correlation with galaxy fields for Euclid satellite. If you want to read more about this, stay tuned because two twin papers are coming out about this. Future work, we are working to characterize the error using the Monte Carlo approach. We want to extract the signal also from N-body lens CMB maps that go beyond the Born approximation in order to track down the very, very small scales. And possibly placing constraints on different cosmological histories, so forecasting how good different experimental setups can be in discriminating between different expansion histories with this approach. And also I'm trying to carry on the work of forecast on non-standard cosmological parameters using Planck and Euclid specifications. So hope I didn't go too long out of time. Thanks for your attention.
Yeah, just back to the models that you're trying to compare with from the N-body simulations. All of those models listed there don't include a screening mechanism. So I would say that beta of order one, beta zero of order one is probably already constrained and probably already ruled out.
What?
So this parameter here, beta zero, this is the parameter which is giving you most of the change in your nonlinear structure.
Yes.
those values are
sorry,
quite
sorry, I may interrupt you. What we have here is lambda CDM, exp003 and sugar003. So these two and this one are not to be considered.
Okay. So it's still going beta of order 10 to the minus 1. That's quite strong.
We didn't get maps for beta 0.1. That's why I wanted to make the point.
My main question was that these things show deviations from say set equals 3 onwards. What have you thought about doing it for things which do have a screening mechanism?
Well, this is an interesting thing to consider. The point is that having a map with a different cosmological history requires having the full simulation box and screenshots at every interval of Z. Then you have to do all the stacking, all the rotation, and then you have to do all the ray tracing. So, once that one has the complete machinery, you can do it, but it is something that takes some non-zero computational time. I mean, basically, I think that it's interesting to produce this kind of boxes / CFB maps for all the models that still haven't been excluded. So yeah, I mean, all the screening mechanism models are definitely to be looked at because it's another way to get the evolution. But then in the end, I think that the most interesting thing, maybe from my point of view, is looking at models that really produce differences in the tail, like some tilt or some characteristic shape. Because otherwise, basically, we know that we are lying in a certain interval of confidence. So in order to not to become too much model dependent, it's important to not to plug in too many models, because otherwise you can constrain all the possible models and still you're not really able to say, okay, I'm distinguishing between this and that or not. Because then when it comes to dark energy, now that there is a whole zoology of models that are basically every day a new model is coming out. So I definitely think that screening mechanism and also all other FOVR models are worth to be looked at and given a shot with this analysis. Maybe something interesting comes out.
Any more questions for Claudio? Thanks, speaker again.